Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It's one of the most shocking unsolved missing child cases in the world. Where is Kyron Horman? Why hasn't the woman who police suspect is responsible for his 2010 disappearance, Kyron's stepmother, been charged? That the 7-year-old disappeared from his grade school got the attention of parents around the world. The twists of the case, adultery, sexting, murder for hire, keep the story in the media spotlight. New York Times bestselling author Rebecca Morris tells the minute-by-minute, day-by-day story of the long investigation, the search for Kyron, and his family's heartache. Based on years of research and interviews with Kyron's family, Boy Missing also examines what recourse families have as they wait for a loved one to be found and challenges a common assumption in no-body cases, that prosecutors must wait until there is a confession or remains are found. No-body cases can be prosecuted successfully. The book that we're featuring this evening is Boy Missing, The Search for Kyron Horman, with my special guest journalist and author, Rebecca Morris. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Rebecca Morris.
Yeah, hi, Dan. It's great to be back with you again.
Great to have you back. Thank you very much. You talk about June 4th, 2010, and that's the day you and others began following this case of Kyron Horman's disappearance. As you do in the book, let's not waste any time. Let's get right to June 4th, 2010. Set the stage where this is, this school, the Skyline Elementary. Tell us about this school and what were the situation that presented itself at that school that day with all these extra people. Not a normal day at this school. Tell us about this.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. Excuse me. Skyline Elementary School is in Portland, Oregon, but is not in the city limits. It's in Multnomah County, and it's about 16 miles northwest, excuse me, of the city of Portland. And that was a very busy day at the school. There was 1 week left of school. Kyron was 7 years old in second grade, and it was the day of the school science fair. All the students in the sixth grades, plus kindergarten, had done science exhibits. Kyron had done his on the red-eyed true frog, and had a diorama and had worked very hard on this. So there are 400 extra people in this small rural school on June 10th because they were, you know, parents, grandparents, siblings who'd come on that Friday to see the science exhibits. Kyron lived with his father and his stepmother. That's a long story we'll get into, I'm sure, about why he was only part-time with his birth mother, who was a couple hundred miles south in Oregon. But his stepmother said that they walked around school. She took a picture of him in front of his red-eyed tree frog exhibit. And then she said she waved to him as he went into his classroom, and she and her 19-month-old baby girl left for several hours. When Kane Horman, Kyron's father, and his stepmother, Terry Horman, went to meet the bus in the afternoon, Kyron wasn't on the bus, and they immediately rushed to the school. One of the saddest parts of this is he'd been missing 6 hours before anybody knew he was missing. That's a lot of time after a child is abducted or missing, a long time.
Let's talk about the situation. We just did a brief outline of what happens that day. There's a science fair set up, and there was all these people. And unlike schools today, I guess people would be familiar with, there was no name tags. The school was unlocked. There were seven doors in and out of the school that were unlocked. So kind of different sense of security, I think, than we might understand today present at schools.
Yeah.
But tell us
and
about...
No cameras.
Right, no cameras as well, and very important. Tell us about the living situation that Kyren was in with his father, Kane, the stepmother, Terry, and his real mother, Desiree, and her new husband, Tony. Tell us about the situation and why Desiree was not, Kyren was not principally living with Desiree.
Yeah, and this is something that immediately people leapt to some assumption. Well, there must be a reason he wasn't living with his birth mother. Well, the reason was that she had been had shared custody. So Desiree Young, who's Kyren's birth mother, and she had remarried and was married to Tony Young, who's a detective in the Medford, Oregon Police Department. And when Desiree had divorced her second husband, Kane. Somebody said you need a scorecard to keep track of all the marriages, and that's very possible. But she also had a son by an earlier marriage, and you know Desiree had never had good health. She went to Canada one summer to seek some medical treatment, and when she came back, the two men who were the fathers of her sons would not give the children back. She fought a long court battle, and a judge finally decided in Portland that the boy should stay where they'd been living for a couple of years, and it was just kind of heartbreaking. So Desiree did have, you know, partial custody, and both boys, when Kyren was seven, her other son was 15 at the time, I believe. And so they spent, you know, a lot, half their lives were in Medford with Tony and Desiree, but half their lives were with their father, respective fathers, and stepmothers and step-siblings in the Portland area. It was that weekend, June 4th, was Desiree's weekend to get the boys. So she was driving. She would have been driving to Portland anyway to pick up the boys, but she got a phone call from the school secretary around 4 o'clock, you know, notifying her that Kyren was missing. And, of course, she, you know, really rushed up to Portland then. Everybody kind of assumed it was probably, you know, he was taken from his school or he went wandering outside during the confusion and was lost or something. But it was, you know, actually a much darker kind of, you know, missing child story.
The idea that, tell us more about this science fair itself in terms of what Terry said in terms of the timeline. She said she went there, they went to some of the exhibits, and then, of course, classes started after that. So explain this science fair and what how it was conducted, but then the kids went into their classrooms. Why was he not reported missing? Tell us about that earlier arrangement that Terry had made and may have added to the confusion that day.
Sure. Well, Terry Horman, the stepmother, it was also her third marriage. The police have never used the word suspect because there are all kinds of legal ramifications with that. They haven't been able to charge her, but she definitely was, you know, the suspect from that first weekend, and very much with police and of course with Desiree and her family. They just immediately thought Terry had a hand in this. And in fact, it looks like it was planned because she picked a day, if she is responsible for Kyren's disappearance, and we think so, she picked a day when there'd be a lot of confusion at the school. And she said that she'd parked in the school parking lot, and she didn't, and was actually caught later in several lies. But as you mentioned, the doors were open, there were no security cameras, no name tags, nothing. They walked around looking at the science exhibits. The reason that nobody knew Kyron was gone was that his second grade teacher knew he was, because Terry, the stepmother, had sent her an email a couple of days before that she'd be taking Kyron to a doctor's appointment. And so the teacher marked him absent, but it was called an excused absence. And because right. there, you know, in the corner of the room was Kyron's jacket and backpack, where they had left it, and that he was going mm-hmm. to the doctor. Well, Terry said she left him at school, and in fact the doctor's appointment was reportedly for a week later. So just, you know, the confusion, that simple, that confusion just caused a lot more confusion. So it wasn't until until he didn't get off the school bus 6 hours later that the school knew he was really missing and hadn't come back after some doctor's appointment. And there were other really significant lies that Terry Horman was caught in. I report for the first time in the book that she was seen leaving the school with him and with her infant daughter, that there were a couple of adults and classmates of Kyron's who saw her leave the school with him. So that's pretty powerful, you know, circumstantial evidence.
But we don't see that right away, and everybody doesn't find this
yeah.
out. And it's a very interesting dynamic in that right away Desiree and her husband Tony. Now, tell our audience who Tony is, and also this is quite a drive before they get to the house, before they get
yeah.
to Terry and her ex-husband Kane's house. And again, the surprises once they get there, the things that don't seem right to them.
Right.
Tell us about who Tony is, and
yeah.
and a little bit about their visit and their impression when they got to the home of Terry
yeah.
and Kane.
Well, Tony Young, Desiree's husband, is and Kyron's stepfather. He was just an amazing, amazing part of this book, because he's just retired in the last month, but he was a 20-year veteran detective in Medford, Oregon, and basically his whole adult life he'd been a detective. And he and his friends, fellow detectives, were there in Portland observing everything, you know, for months, for years, really, for 10 years. And so they were told, and Tony was told, you know, don't go near the command center, don't talk to cops up here. And, you know, he knew there was a good reason for that, but they were there observing. And, you know, you can dim the switch a little, but you can't turn it off. And so their impressions were, you know, terribly important to the book. The book was pretty difficult to do because it's an open case, and that means there's no case file to look at. Detectives aren't going to talk to you. You know, there's been no charging, there's no, you know, trial transcript, none of that. So the people that were there observing and watching were very important to this. But what you're referring to is when Tony and Desiree finally arrive at Kane's house, where Kyron lived. You know, the stepmother, Terry Horman, throws open the door and welcomes them and greets them and says there's lots of food that's been dropped off. And they said it was so weird. It was like she was
yeah.
hosting a party. There
mm-hmm.
was nothing said about, gosh, I'm sorry. You know, she hadn't been crying. Everybody else was crying. But she just acted like, you know, she was kind of hostessing a party.
It's very interesting, too, when you talk about the reaction from Terry, but also that police wanted the parents to be in the same house. So they tell us about this. Tell about this very
yeah.
unique request in light of what had happened, and to keep these witnesses and this crime scene secure. What did the detectives request
yeah.
these four parents do?
Well, that was one of the most interesting things. And, you know, I don't think it's unusual for police to kind of lock down a house. And remember, Kane's house was considered one of two possible crime scenes. There was the school, and there was Kane's house. But usually when they're locking down, you know, and keeping, it might be one, you know, one family, and they stay with the family to answer the phone calls and kind of have a base of operations there. But here you have, you know, a blended family, a family that had not blended very well.
Yeah.
And who didn't really like each other very much. And although Tony and Desiree, you know, got along fairly well with Kane, especially that first year that Kyron was missing. But it was just strange. They had to all sleep there and stay there. And if they were eating, they ate meals there. And that lasted several days. And it's so, I think the police were really smart about, you know, that observing the interactions and having people observe Terry Horman, who, you know, were not married to her, who were, you know, in her life, but who were, you know, could be somewhat, maybe a little bit, have different observations than her husband might have. They did kind of align themselves with Kane, Terry's husband, early on, and had him wearing a wire when nobody else knew about it. But that lasted several days, and then eventually Desiree and Tony were allowed to move to a motel, but they had to spend their days still back at the house. And there was a command center nearby for, you know, all law enforcement, just, you know, like 40 agencies. And but still the house was kind of ground zero.
For those people that don't know, how big a case was this for the media, and how big, and what was the magnitude of the search that was that they underway?
Well, it was. It's a huge story. It still is, and not just, you know. I grew up in Oregon, so I'm kind of, you know, defend a little bit the fact that it, yes, it's an Oregon story, but it was as national and international as anything you can name, as you know, as Madeleine McCann and Missing in Portugal, or Natalie Holloway, you know, Casey Anthony, JonBenet Ramsey. It was huge, and it was the parents, just Kane and Desiree. They were on Dr. Phil. They were on Oprah, Dateline. I mean, and not only at that time, but national media continues to cover this, including the 10th anniversary, which was just two weeks ago, as you know. So it's a big story locally, a big story nationally, and the fact that that a child, like you said in the lead, that a child would go missing from their school is pretty unusual. And Ernie Allen, who's the retired now head of NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in both this country and in Europe, has said that, you know, where a child goes missing from, the situation has a lot to do with how the story is covered by the media and what catches the media's interest. In this case, this story just kept paying off and paying off and paying off, because it turns out that the stepmother, Terry Horman, was, you know, a real piece of something. And all kinds of things materialized and in the next few weeks with regard to her. And, it just was a story that never, well, it didn't end, but not just because Kyron hasn't been found. It just continues to play out to this day.
Right. This really is also, of course, Desiree's personal story, and you do talk about Desiree's problem background, her childhood, But also that Desiree does everything, and I know that this is a common story with these mothers, but she goes over and beyond to try to do everything in her power to try to get who she thinks is a suspect, is the suspect, Kyron's stepmother, and find out why, to pressure everybody she possibly could, to reach out to the media, to do everything she possibly could, and then still did more later, became an advocate and dedicated her life to the cause, and still held out hope for that her boy was still alive, remarkably, after all these years. Tell us a little bit more about Desiree and the efforts and the extent that she did to keep this story alive, to have other people involved, and everything she did. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I will correct one thing you said. As early as, I believe it was the first or second weekend he was missing, she had a moment where she felt Kyron came to her and was telling her that he was gone. So she, early on, she didn't tell anybody but her husband, but she believed by the second week that Kyron was dead. It's Kane who continues to believe that Kyron is somewhere. Maybe he was handed off or he was sold or something. So she really accepted early on he's dead, but she wants him back. She will do anything that she can. And it's really, I think, what one of the things that's really unique about her is that she, you know, is a cop's wife. She's a detective's wife. So she knew there were parameters to what she could do, and that sometimes the most effective thing is to let the person, who's the suspect, rant, talk, look bad, paint themselves, let them do damage to themselves, as Terry Horman did with this. And kind of, in a way, you're doing everything you can for your son, but you're also respectful of things have to play out. And I think she was, just terribly wise in a way that most parents wouldn't be, that the woman who did this, most likely, is going to be her own worst enemy. And that eventually, she'll get tripped up. And she has been tripped up several times. But Desiree has done some things that I don't know that most parents maybe wouldn't do. She, after the first couple of years of searching, which was extensive, and I'll mention that, but she's organized some private searches, and she does it, and then she tells the police, who are still investigating, that tomorrow I've got some trained searchers coming in who are volunteering to go over some places. So she was pretty savvy in that way, and she admits the very first time they did that they didn't know what they were doing, but she and her sister, who is at her side all the time, they figured out how to do this. But the search was extensive. It was hundreds of thousands of acres. And what complicated it is that it wasn't, they don't live in a city like, Elizabeth Smart was taken in Utah from the home. It was in the middle of a city, and then, kept for a while up in back on this wooded hillside. This is a rural area, so they had the roads, and I've driven them many times in that area, are it's old forest. It's very steep terrain on one side and then ravines on the other side. The areas they had to search were just extremely dense. We're talking chest high ferns and bushes and woods, and then, which a part of the geography that may also play a part in the story, is that just to the east is where two rivers, the Columbia and the Willamette, meet, and there's an island, Savi Island, there, and there are, ponds, lakes, marshes, and there's this story that may be an urban myth or may not be an urban myth, that a fisherman went overboard one day and was never seen again because the current will take you to the Pacific Ocean, which is just 100 miles away. So the current is very fast, and there's all this water. Terry Horman, one of the most important things is she's off the grid for 2.5 hours that morning after she supposedly left Chiron at school. She said she was driving around trying to quiet her infant daughter, that she had a earache, and she stopped at two stores looking for Motrin. You can't see by the angles of the camera if there's anybody in the, you know, on the floor of the
right.
truck or in the back seat or anything. But she does buy some stuff, and then she's, you know, nowhere to be seen for 2.5 hours. Her cell phone pings on a tower that's right in the middle between the island and the rivers I told you about, and then
right.
where the school is. And she just said she was driving back roads trying to keep her daughter asleep, and it's there's some sightings of her truck. She said she pulled over and, you know, changed a diaper or something. Then she stopped at her gym. She lied about how long she was there, and
right.
And then she's back home and, you know, on Facebook, posting the picture she took of Chiron at school, and touching base with Desiree about the picture. And then she and her little girl and Chiron's father walk to meet the bus, and he's not on the bus. So there's also a friend of Terry Horman's, we find out a couple weeks later, who's missing from her job during that same 2 hours.
That's right.
And they've never been able to, you know, decide if she was, you know, if Terry picked her up and she helped, or what she knew. They're pretty closed mouths about all this. And then eventually, in the first couple weeks, so Terry Horman fails 2 lie detector tests and walks
right.
out on the third.
Right. What do police do in terms of grand jury, in terms of them compelling her to answer more questions? They realize her timeline is fraught with problems, and that and her timeline changes and her story changes to accommodate the last story and the changes. How do police proceed mm-hmm. with those polygraphs, and what's their option to deal with her in this case?
Well, of course, you know, she was never named a suspect, and people have, you know, people have rights. She never was called before the grand jury. She, you know, had the right to walk out of a third polygraph. Things happened very quickly after the first, at about the 3-week mark, and which, you know, she suddenly found herself on her own, and she hired the most expensive, the best known criminal defense lawyer in Oregon, and she didn't have to talk anymore to the police or appear before a grand jury. So they didn't have much place to go. The law enforcement didn't after that, except trying to pick apart her timeline, which, you know, the parents were all asked that first evening, you know, do a timeline, tell us exactly where you were. Desiree and Tony were, of course, you know, very quickly ruled out, because they were 300 miles away in southern Oregon. It was easy to tell that. But they did timelines anyway. Terry was the only one who had trouble doing a timeline and kept changing it. So even after her first one, where she talks about stopping at the two stores looking for Motrin, then she cooked up other places that she said she stopped, but there was never any proof that she stopped at the dry cleaners or stopped at the arts and crafts store. But it just got very muddy very quickly, and all the parents, you know, were pretty suspicious of her very quickly.
We're going to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. Time to customize your FabFitFun box for the summer season. My wife Lisa was excited, of course, to receive another FabFitFun summer box and everything inside. She especially liked the insulated picnic bag from Business and Pleasure and the reed diffuser from Solstice and from Myriad, the Environmental Shield Energizing Cleansing Cream. She's always excited to get another FabFitFun box. Every box is curated specifically to each person because you select what goes into your box each season. It's the perfect way to treat yourself or someone else. Get the products you really want when you customize your box online, with most of the items customizable. The boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. Also, connect with women throughout the world in FabFitFun's community forum. Join a members-only club for cooking or books, or meet new friends to swap products with. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. Sign up today to receive your first box and join a community of over 1 million women who are already obsessed. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at FabFitFun.com. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. That's $10 off when you use code MURDER at FabFitFun.com. Now, Rebecca, we were talking about everyone looking at the only suspect, it seemed, in this case was Terry Horman, but Desiree and Tony are privy to some things from the investigators that are in this task force and are trying to solve this case, and they're finding more and more about Terry's personal life, the relationship with Kane, but also a possible motive for why she would want to harm Kyron. Tell us about a little bit of the information she finds out in this investigation.
Well, especially in the first few months, Desiree comes to believe that Terry has been manipulating Kyron and scaring him and hiding his favorite toys and books. And she apparently cooked up a scheme where in his classroom, I mean, she told Desiree and she told Kane that Kyron was being, you know, he'd get a red card for the day in his second grade, and that meant he should be disciplined. And, you know, other parents in the classroom I talked to said this color-coding, you know, discipline system just didn't exist. It simply didn't exist.
Right.
And so Desiree realized that you know, when and she wishes she thought Kyron, as far as, you know, crying when he was in Medford and saying he didn't want to go back to Portland, you know, everybody thought it was just kind of normal, you know, a step family kind of situation that is not unique. But she, Desiree found out a couple of months into this that Terry had been emailing friends talking about how much she hated Kyron and how much she didn't want to be, you know, a stepmother and his stepmother, and that, in fact, Kane and Terry had been having marriage problems. She found out that they had fought till 3 a.m. on the night, the morning that Kyron went missing. And Terry thought Kane was having an affair. She, you know, the motive seemed to be that Terry wanted to get out of this marriage and have custody of her daughter, the 19-month-old girl. And whatever she had to do to get rid of both Kane and Kyron. And the only good thing I can say about Terry Horman is that the year before, in 2009, she tried to get Kane to let Kyron go live with Desiree in Medford.
Mm-hmm.
And the you know, Terry, the stepmother, tried to do that, and Kane wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
And so then it became, how does she get rid of both of them? Maybe get, you know, really get rid of Kane and have his life insurance, send Kyron back to Desiree, and then she and her daughter would, you know, have the life insurance and start a new life. It sounds crazy. I mean, it was. It is.
Sure.
But that appeared to be her motive, whatever it would take to be rid of both her husband and her stepson. And that's what she, you know, undertook.
There was also a resentment for her son from a previous marriage named John that was forced to go live with the grandparents, and she resented Cain for that. Could you explain that as well?
Yes. So her son, who was a teenager, her son by her first marriage, who then Terry's second husband had adopted him, but he was a teenager, as was Desiree's other son, and he lived with Cain and Terry and Kyron. And Desiree believed that John was, you know, a partner in kind of manipulating Kyron and giving him a hard time. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, we're a little bit unclear about exactly what happened, but John was sent to Roseburg, where Terry's parents lived. So he lived with his grandparents, and Cain said it happened when he was out of town. But Terry blamed Cain and blamed Kyron for that her son was sent away, but that, you know, Kyron could still live there. So all of this was building up. Cain said later, admitted when in divorce, both divorce and a custody battle also, that Terry was drinking a lot. He'd found her passed out at night with, you know, with the two young children, kind of, you know, on their own there. And years before she married Cain, she'd had quite a number of speeding tickets and tickets, but she'd also had a DUI with her son in the car, which is pretty serious business. That's in, you know, mm-hmm. you lose your license for a year, and you have to sure. go to alcohol counseling and everything if you have a minor in the car when you're stopped. So things were kind of, you know, coming to light over time, but to find out, as Desiree found out, that Terry really hated Kyron and, you know, wanted something to happen to him, that was, you know, that was pretty disturbing.
Now, let's get back to what the police are trying to do here. I mean, they've assembled a lot of detectives. They spent a lot of money. You talk about this search yeah. and this investigation, $1.4 million. So there's a yeah. lot of dedication to this, an incredible amount of money spent in the search, but there really was a quest to be able to convict this woman. So they tried a few ploys. This case, of course, of sex and that we talked about sexting and adultery, so that's yeah. what really yeah. gets people's attention, even more so than a boy yeah. kidnapped from a school. But this is really gets people interested. So there was an opportunity by the prosecutors to try to attempt to do something mm-hmm. to pressure Terry. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Well, shortly after Kyron went missing, probably I think about the 3 or 4 week mark, they find, of course, they're reading Terry's emails and her, you know, her computer and her cell phone, and they find out that she had hired a landscaper at some point, and somehow they find out she'd never told her husband about it. So they decide, gosh, why would she hire a landscaper and keep it secret? So they found him, and he said that she had tried to hire him, well, to find somebody that would kill her husband. So could, his name's Rodolfo Sanchez, would he help her find somebody who could, you know, who would be a hitman? And she offered him $10,000, and, you know, he didn't say much and turned her down, apparently. But eventually the police find him, and she had also, as early as the fall of 2009, several months before, talked to somebody else about, could they help her find a hitman? And so they send Rodolfo, the landscaper, with an undercover cop wearing a wire to the house and to talk to Terry and basically to tell her, to ask her, are you still interested? You know, are you still interested in finding somebody to kill your husband? And she was suspicious and didn't fall for it, and called the police, in fact, not realizing they were the police. And so she wasn't really implicated in that, but they believe that when she said that the landscaper had, you know, come on to her and he was getting back at her because she turned him down, that he initially said that she had, you know, she'd also propositioned him sexually. So it just got really messy. Within also a week or two of that, when they told, let me, before I move forward, when they told Kane about, you know, she tried to hire somebody to kill you, so he and the young daughter flee the house, and she finds herself, you know, all alone there. But also within a couple of weeks, they offer her a deal. They have all kinds of, you know, she's been sexting a guy who is high school classmate of Kane's and who's hanging around a lot, and they've got nude pictures of her that she sent and sexting, and they said, you know, if she'll tell them where Kyron is, they'll make a deal with her and not reveal all this. And she turned it down. So they let all that information come out, which is something, you know, Dr. Phil really dug into and, you know, loved to blow up on the screen when she was on the show with him. She did her own 2-hour interview with Dr. Phil a few years later. Yeah. So she's offered a deal. Meanwhile, her friend from, who was also off the grid that day, missing from her job, moves into the house with her for 11 days or something.
Yeah.
And there are people that think that Dee Dee Spicer knows exactly what happened and what happened to Kyron. She was, she said she talked to the grand jury eventually. Desiree's not sure of that. She was deposed later in a civil lawsuit that Desiree brought against Terry Horman. And she just, you know, she pled the Fifth Amendment, I think it's 149 times during her deposition, so not much information from there. I will say it was really interesting. Because the police didn't want the parents to speak initially, and you know, you see everything. You see people like you know, like Elizabeth Smart's parents who spoke about her, and Susan Cox Powell's parents, and then the parents who, you know, are lying about their missing children, like Susan Smith and Casey Anthony, and but the police, as we were talking about, kept a very low profile with the parents on this. So the media, you know, all they could do was get into the juicy stuff, which very much upset Desiree. That you know, they'd be a lot of the stories at that time focused on, you know, the sexting, the marriages, the, you know, Desiree and family wouldn't talk to the media, but Terry Horman's friends would tell the media, well, Terry's really the boy's mother. Terry raised him, you know.
Right.
He thinks of Terry as mother. And so it was very, very hurtful news coverage for Desiree.
And also, they also questioned initially, too, why would the mother not be living with the son? And so they questioned her ability as a mother there.
They make assumptions that there must be something wrong with the birth mother.
Yeah.
And there wasn't. It was just that her two ex-husbands, when she wanted to take the boys to Canada with her, when she was going to have treatment for kidney disease, and they wouldn't give her, you know, the letters, the paperwork to take her children across the border to Canada. And then when she finally said, okay, well, they can stay with you a couple months, and Kane got it in writing. Not that they would, you know, it also said they would be returned to her And then when she came back after her medical treatment, they wouldn't give her the boys. And she fought for 2 years, long and hard. And finally a judge ruled they should continue to live where they were living, that they were young enough that it would make a difference to keep living where they were living. And she would have, you know, half custody. It was a pretty, you know, it was a dirty deal.
Now, the police are trying to do all they can, and eventually this group of detectives, of like 200 detectives assigned to this, it's all scaled back, and there's a task force, and ends up with just one detective. They've tried everything with the grand jury, but the DD won't say anything. Terry has got a great lawyer, so she didn't want to say anything. There's civil lawsuits, but they're also worried about the kind of information that could come up in these civil lawsuits, other than criminal proceedings. Tell us a little bit more about the danger, the hazard of raising certain things at these hearings.
Well, I believe a civil suit, when there hasn't been a murder charge, I think you have just 2 or 3 years to actually bring a civil suit. So Desiree found a good attorney, and just about at the 2-year mark, so that'd be June of 2012, she filed a civil suit against Terry Horman for, you know, millions of dollars, but that isn't what interested Desiree. Mm-hmm. But Terry would have been compelled to say, you know, where Kyron is. And what's very tricky here is that Desiree and her attorney would really need the police case file, such as it was at that point. They would need that for their civil lawsuit. And Desiree says that it's the county sheriff's office, actually. Their detectives, you know, grudgingly said, okay, we'll share it with you when you need it. But then the next year, when the time came, they wouldn't share it with them. And Desiree reluctantly, you know, understood, because the only person who knows what the police know is Terry Horman. And they don't want to tip their hand and let her know what they know. The sheriff at one point said at a news conference, choking up, he said, we know things we wish we didn't know. And that you know, implies some pretty nasty things. And also at about that time, Desiree was told that they'd found Kyron's DNA in the bed of his father's pickup truck, which was considered, you know, unusual. There's really no reason his DNA should be back of the truck. And she wasn't told if it was blood or hair or urine or what, but it was DNA. So when they couldn't get the police file to continue the civil suit, then she had to drop the civil suit. So it's very tricky, because do you want to tip, you know, you want to explain what the police do know, or as I get into in the book, and you're referring to no body cases, prosecutors are, you know, most of the time reluctant to bring murder charges when there's no body.
Sure.
It can be done. It can be done successfully. It can be prosecuted successfully. But juries, you know, every potential juror in America is watching TV crime shows and forensic shows. And there are police who think that actually hampers cases. Jurors think there should be DNA. Jurors think that this can be wrapped up really, you know, quickly. And it's just not like that. You have to go on you know, circumstantial evidence. And I talk to experts who say, well, you know, those eyewitnesses who saw Terry leave the school with Kyron, that's pretty strong circumstantial evidence, eyewitnesses.
Mm-hmm.
But to date, there have been no arrests.
It's interesting and heartbreaking to see that Desiree, every effort she makes to try to find her son, to find justice for her son, But yeah. One of the common things that she does is simply just tries to implore Terry to speak. Just tell us a little bit more about some of the, she reaches out in public through the media.
Yeah. I don't think there's been one time, within a couple of months after Kyron disappeared, Kane and Desiree and Tony were free to begin to speak. And, of course, Terry was by then, you know, either hunkered down in the house, or then when she had to leave Kane's house, she, you know, fled to her parents in Southern Oregon, and she would appear in Portland for, various legal meetings. But she was gone, but they used every opportunity to implore her to speak. And I think to this day, including the 10th anniversary a couple weeks ago, that there is no time when Desiree talks about Kyron that she doesn't call on Terry. So, you know, the good part about that is it keeps the focus on Terry. It keeps the pressure on her. And I also write in the book about, you know, this amazing community that, adopted Kyron, if you will, after he went missing.
Yeah.
And who, the people who run the Facebook pages, you know, they have 500,000 people that follow this on Facebook. The people who live in California, where Terry Horman lives now, and kind of keep an eye on her. You know,
right.
We've been told where she works. She got married for the fourth time, you know, about 2 years ago. You know, sometimes we know what job she has, all kinds of things. When she buys a house, when she changes cars, you know, people, and the police, I'm sure, are watching her. So, some people couldn't stand that kind of constant examination. For some reason, Terry Horman's able to stand up to that, ignore it. Basically, she, you know, ignores it. She does not issue statements at all. Not since, I don't think since maybe 2016, when she was on Dr. Phil and for 2 hours, and basically, you know, stuck to her story.
There is a lot of, just like you said, you became obsessed with this case immediately after that, and so many people online, and you just touched on that, but you do mention some people and provide their websites. Maybe you can tell us a couple people, including Web Sleuths, that you just offer up as really good sources of people that were looking into this case and look into all kinds of other unsolved cases.
Well, I think those kinds of citizen bloggers are important. That doesn't mean I think they're going to find anything or solve anything,
mm-hmm.
but as far as keeping the word out there. And on the other hand, there are examples in the book of when, you know, when it goes too far, or, I've written books about other missing people and families who wanted to know what psychics have to say. And
right.
I think people speculating, I'm not sure what that adds or how it helps Kyron, you know, how it helps to find Kyron. I think it's good to keep the interest, if it helps keep the interest on Kyron and keeps pressure on Terry. But I don't think speculation, I've never seen it lead to some kind of breakthrough. I haven't. Maybe other people have.
Right. Now, with this as well, Desiree inadvertently or as a result of this becomes an advocate for change and does a lot of mm-hmm. public speaking, where she originally was a pretty shy person. And so she has changed and become a real fighter in this. Tell us a little bit more about some of the advocacy and some of the outreach that she does, some of the things, public speaking that she does.
Well, I never met the shy Desiree Young, because by the time I met her in 2017, I wrote to her expressing interest in writing her story and Kyron's story and the story of the search. But according to Tony, her husband, you know, she describes herself as, you know, a very shy, timid person. But she's really found her voice, and I just really admire how she's taken her own experience and reached out to others and reached out to help others. She's spoken to Amber Alert conventions. Of course, an Amber Alert wasn't pertinent to Kyron because you have to have a car and a license plate and all of that, and that wasn't the case here. But she speaks to Amber Alert conventions. She speaks to the training of police departments called CART training, and it's a training of police departments and sheriff's departments so that they will be prepared in a missing child case. And there's still lots of places around the country that wouldn't know what to do. But Multnomah County had this training, so they knew, you know, you keep the family in the house. You designate a police spokesperson. You know, you don't have the family making pleas right off the bat. And
right.
you get their cell phones, you get their computers. You know, just what has to be done very quickly, because remember, they lost, you know, 6 hours. And
right.
Some talking heads, because when the police weren't talking to the media would go to talking heads, you know, like retired cops or other people who would, somebody said, well, they really lost 12 hours that day. Now, I'm not sure how they lost 12 hours, but you know, there are all kinds of people that say things. So CART training is very important, and Desiree, when other, municipalities in Oregon are having police training, she'll go and talk. And obviously she's speaking as a parent, you know. And she talks about what Multnomah County did right, what they did right that she thinks really made a difference, even though they didn't find Kyron yet. But, you know, and of course she's the wife of a retired cop, and she's pro-police. But she also then, you know, organizes her own searches, she'll, you know, she's candid with the police, and she'll ask them, you know, she asks them a lot of questions. She stays in touch, she, you know, is out there. And one thing she did is there's a group of volunteers who are parents, who've been parents of missing children or at one time missing children, and she did some work with them, and then it just, you know, it was kind of too soon and too close, and she, I think, had a little trouble separating herself from, you know, she's supposed to be anonymous with the parents that she's reaching out to, and that worked for a while, and then it didn't work so well. She speaks on National Missing Children Day, Children's Day, and Oregon's Missing Children's Day, you know, all of it is about wanting to bring Kyron home.
Yeah.
So she did stop speaking to Kyron's father, Kane, after several months when she realized that, and came to feel, when she found out more about their troubled marriage and Terry drinking and passing out, and Terry manipulating Kyron, she realized that she really came to believe that Kyron had been at risk, and his father should have known that boy was at risk, that the stepmother posed a risk. And so they don't work opposite each other, but they don't do events together anymore. And Kane does his things, and Desiree does hers.
When we talk about the science fair that Kyron was so pumped about with his tree frog exhibit And so what did they do from this diorama? And tell us what changes have been made at the Skyline Elementary as a result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, somebody worked with the PTA at the school, got cameras donated that summer, so that by the time school opened in the fall, there were some cameras. They began a system of, and I've been to the school, I don't think you get a name card, but you have to check in on a computer that you're visiting the school. So there's some new routine there, and I believe the doors are locked during the day, or all but the front door, which wasn't the case. And then there's not, there've been some talk about more security, and the school district has said it just doesn't have the money necessarily. But a newer rural school, a big rural new school would have more security than this little rural school. And then some older schools in the city, in Portland, don't necessarily have up to date security. So it's still something that Desiree feels strongly about, that if there had been, cameras in 2010, some kind of system, maybe he wouldn't have walked out with his stepmother.
Well, that's one person commenting on this case said that approaching this like it's a missing persons case for too long can be dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and that maybe they should have very quickly that first evening decided much quicker than they did that this is not, the boy did not wander off. He didn't go out looking for a frog to bring back at his exhibit. Kyron was shy and timid like his mother. He wouldn't have done that. And that for too many hours, and maybe that's where the 12 hours comes in, but for the first several days, they thought he'd been, abducted or wandered away. And then very quickly settled on, it was probably a family member.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if they would have had the cameras and they would have approached this a little bit differently, then they would have been looking at her more seriously than this incredible search. Later they had the searches near, like you mentioned, Savi Island, where the phone pings. But again, why did they do this exhaustive search before they found out about where her telephone put her and where she was in what area? So it's a lot to be learned from this case, I think.
Yeah, it's just, terribly sad. I mean, there wasn't, nobody except, Kyron's father thinks that he's, at least Kane says he still believes Kyron is alive and somewhere. But I don't think any of the detectives believe that, and Desiree doesn't, but what could you do with a boy in 2.5 hours? They think maybe she was scouting locations the week before when she was driving her own sports car instead of her husband's pickup, and maybe she did some scouting. Desiree also says that there's some things missing from Kane's house, and that when Kyron is found, it'll help tell them that she was responsible. Where is he? And we're talking about, we're not talking about, Utah, Idaho, Nevada, where Susan Cox Powell is missing somewhere, where there are just, 10,000 abandoned mines. We're talking about, an area of northwest Portland.
Yeah, 26,000 acres,
Like, frankly, about the book, besides telling their stories, so at the end of the book, I have everybody who's a character in the book, all 20 people whatever, in their own words, say what they think happened, including Desiree and her husband and their other detective friends and the women that run the Facebook pages and the PTA president and, what happened and who was responsible and... some think she's, somewhere in a marsh on Savi Island. something that she buried him, and I don't know. I'll just, as an aside, I don't think I've been dreaming about this for the 3 years I've been working on it, but I had a dream 2 nights ago about maybe he's buried in sand. For the first time, I dreamt, well, maybe he's in sand and there's a tide or something, so he'll never be found because of the sand coming in and out. Or,
interesting.
You know.
Good a guess as anyone, I think, at this point.
Yeah. But I worked on this book with a picture of Chiron and Desiree, the two of them, you know, by my computer for 3 years, just so I could look at them all the time.
Yeah. Well, you've really brought this case to life. I mean, bad pun, I would imagine. But incredible story. And again, still an open investigation, and Desiree and others are hoping that someday there can be more information to find out the entire truth. They believe they know who did it, but they need more answers. I want to thank
you
very much for coming. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say police need a confession or a body.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We'll hope for something to happen someday.
Thank you, Dan.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Boy Missing. It's been fascinating. The search for Chiron Horman. Is there a website that people might take a look at? Do you have a personal website, Facebook page?
Sure, I do. It's Rebecca Morris TB. I'm sorry, my website is Rebecca T. Morris, middle initial T, and the book is available on Amazon, Powell's, Barnes & Noble, e-book and paperback, and the audiobook will be out in July.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much, Rebecca Morris, Boy Missing, Search for Chiron Horman. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
And have a great evening.
Thanks.
Good night.